J-Pal Speaks, we dig out the important stuff so you don't have to. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today, I do believe, the 11th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jay Powell went up to Capitol Hill today. The Fed chair did his twice yearly congressional briefing for lawmakers. Technically, in case you're curious, called the Monetary Policy Report. The TLDR goes like this. Economy is basically fine. Yeah, he's a bit worried about coronavirus. Trade has settled somewhat, but he's keeping an eye on it. Interest rates aren't going anywhere. But then at one point in his report, Powell, he wrote this, and this is a quote, "Levels of business debt continue to be elevated, with the riskiest firms accounting for most of the increase in debt in recent years." Now, the reason that's a worry? Well, because when, not if, but when things go economically south, that debt is going to be harder to pay back, and that is not a good thing. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Interest rates are low right now by historic standards. It doesn't cost a lot to borrow money. Chris Zaccarelli at Independent Advisor Alliance says it's true for a family buying a house.
You have a higher credit score and you're enabled to lower mortgage rates or lower car loans, whereas if you were considered more of a risky borrower, you'd have to pay higher interest rates. The same thing is true for corporations.
And it's the high-risk corporate bonds that are on the rise. This isn't the Amazon, Google, Nike, Facebooks of the world with plenty of cash on hand. Zaccarelli says it's
companies that are very capital intensive in terms of having property, plant, equipment, so industrial companies, energy companies.
Especially those exposed to risks, like drilling for oil or buying land. Some pension and mutual funds are looking to higher risk bonds because returns aren't high enough on safer investments, says University of Portland finance professor Brian Adams.
They need to earn 5-7%. To be able to do that, they got to find riskier debt now.
This rise in low-grade corporate debt could be dangerous if companies start to see sales fall and cash flow decline, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
Do they pay on their debt, start to pull back on their hiring and investment? That will exacerbate the economic downturn.
Similar to how risky mortgage debt contributed to the financial crisis a decade ago. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Marketplace corporate report continues now. We take a turn to the Mergers and Acquisitions Department. A federal judge has approved T-Mobile's takeover of Sprint. Suffice it to say, lots of ups and downs and starts and stops over the past 7 years with this deal, which, when done, by the way, will leave us with not four, but three, count them, three main players in the wireless market. We note that because the sign-off on this deal came on the same day that the Federal Trade Commission announced it is going to go back in time, so to speak, and take a closer look at some past acquisitions by Google and Amazon and Facebook and a couple of others. So we've gotten Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, in the studio with me to make me smart on why some tech mergers, it seems, Molly, are okay and some maybe not. What do you think?
I mean, I guess so. And and I can't deny that it is a bit of a mixed message at a time when antitrust concerns are ramping up. We have now taken the telecommunications and wireless industry down to, in a really notable fashion, three wireless providers. Now, the key differences I should note, though, is that in this case, it's two big companies merging.
Yep.
Versus what the FTC says it's going to look at, which is a whole bunch of big companies that bought up smaller companies that could have grown into their competition.
Huh.
So there's an argument that the sort of landscape of the discussion is a little bit different, but I'm not going to lie, it's still strange.
That's a pretty sophisticated argument, right? talk to me about T-Mobile and Sprint, right? What is the argument that has been made for this being, you know, an okay thing?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One is that this country is very serious about 5G infrastructure, and that is how T-Mobile sold this deal. And you can argue about whether their 5G infrastructure is real, but T-Mobile went to the Hill and said, if you allow us to do this, we will have the spectrum to build out a nationwide 5G infrastructure.
Do you believe that? Because we've seen those 5G maps and it ain't there. And, you know, every now and then you get like a 5G flash on your phone and then you're like, oh, it's going to be great. And it ain't.
I'm in studio, so you can see me shaking my head.
Right.
Because, again, I think you have to set aside the truth of that argument. That was absolutely the argument. But the other big pitch here, and I think was true, was that Sprint was going to die anyway. So really, what regulator said is we were going to be in a three-carrier situation no matter what. We might as well at least give one of them, the remaining one, a fighting chance against Verizon and AT&T, who are huge and don't have a lot of competition, even with Sprint, even with T-Mobile and Sprint separately.
Okay, so to the FTC announcement today and what's going to happen, are they information gathering or are they actually investigating with possible sanctions in the offing?
That is what remains to be seen, and it's super interesting. The FTC has said that every option is on the table, that they're going to go back and look at these deals as far back to Google and DoubleClick in 2008. And that they are not ruling out the possibility of potentially unwinding some of those deals or using some determination about those deals as a future framework for antitrust. But look, we have ramped up big time on antitrust in this country right now. The FTC's the Department of Justice asked for a 71% budget increase for the Federal Trade Commission to basically hire investigators into antitrust.
You know, this is so interesting. We got 40 seconds left. There is, and I'm not drawing the parallel here, but I'm pointing out that this has become an issue in the Democratic campaign for the presidency, right? Elizabeth Warren specifically talking about Facebook and breaking it up. It's not like this happens in a vacuum.
No, not at all. And it is a really interesting reflection of the political zeitgeist. And you actually, in a weird way, say you see Republicans saying we have to get there first on regulating big tech. And they're going after it pretty hard.
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. And with me, a podcast we do called Make Me Smart, in which I think we've talked about this, right?
Once or twice.
I think so. Once or twice. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street today, pretty much break even, actually. Details, numbers, when we get there. The acronym of the day today is JOLTS, Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. It comes to us from the Department of Labor, the most recent edition this morning, from which we learned that the number of open jobs in this economy fell just a tad at the end of last year to 6.5 million available positions. No big changes in the number of people leaving their jobs. The same can be said, no big changes, in the way that people leave their jobs, even as the nature of work itself in this economy is in flux. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
When Jay Buchalter decided to leave his job as a sales rep for a footwear supply company in Los Angeles a couple years ago, he did what he thought he was supposed to do.
I kind of come from the old school, and it seems to be the industry standard to give 2 weeks' notice.
He figured it would give him time to wrap things up, maybe help train a replacement. But the company didn't even post his job, leaving him feeling inconsequential.
I think 2 weeks' notice does feel a little arbitrary. I really don't know where that came from.
Neither, it seems, does anybody else, including Alex Colvin, the dean of the Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations.
It's a good example of something that doesn't have very clear origins.
Unlike, say, the 40-hour work week, 2 weeks' notice can't be traced to an obvious law or government policy.
You know, in some ways, it's almost a rule of what's reasonable. It's really just a social norm.
When he says likely developed in the 40s and 50s, when a lot of big companies were formalizing their HR practices, and the two-week notice started showing up more in employee handbooks.
You'd go work for a company for your whole career. They would provide you a certain set of benefits. And the idea was also that you, as the employee, owed some loyalty to the company. It was a social contract at work.
A contract that today seems to have very different terms. Chicago IT professional Dana Clyfield was taking some time off from work a couple years ago when she got an attractive job offer.
So I decided to give notice while I was still on vacation so that once I came back, it would be a full 2 weeks for me to transition my responsibilities.
Her boss didn't take it so well. She says her employer was angry she gave notice on vacation, and she wasn't allowed to return to the office to say goodbye or even clean out her desk.
In retrospect, I wouldn't have given 2 weeks' notice at all if I knew that I was going to be essentially punished for it.
Bypassing the two-week notice is becoming more common, according to Tracy Fiat, the CEO of staffing firm Randstad USA. She says the attitude shift is sharpest among younger workers who came of age during the job cuts of the Great Recession.
Their experience, either personally or through watching others, was that they didn't get a two-week notice, so why should they give one?
Even her own teenage daughter planned to just skip out on her summer job as a waitress at a retirement home.
And I said, oh, no, you're not. And she actually looked at me somewhat surprised, saying, well, that's what everyone else does.
For employers, dealing with the aftermath of sudden exits can be tough. Dane Binder oversees healthcare professionals at a crisis center in Tucson that serves people with substance abuse and mental health issues.
We're really trying to navigate a clientele that's very high needs. And without that notice, these folks who are very much in need of our services really do suffer.
Especially when people just up and leave. And it's taking longer than ever to fill open jobs, according to federal data, because of the tight labor market and the increasingly specialized nature of work. Binder says at his crisis center, it takes at least a month to onboard a new employee.
So I think in an ideal world, I would like at least 6 weeks' notice, because 2 weeks is nice, but it's totally inadequate.
Given the current climate, though, he'll take what he can get. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This was not a good day for Under Armour. Shares cratered after the sportswear company reported disappointing earnings and a fourth quarter loss, and it said it might 86 plans to open a flagship store on Fifth Avenue. But really, in this digital day and age of getting what you want, when you want it, right to your front door, what is the point of a flagship store anyway? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra went to the world's most famous flagship address to report the story.
Fifth Avenue is packed with flagship stores. I started on 57th Street, where you'll find all the luxury brands. There's Tiffany, the quintessential American flagship. Also Dolce & Gabbana, Harry Winston, and Louis Vuitton, where you're greeted by giant screens showing models walking the runway.
And you feel like you're in the front row. You're seeing limited edition furniture. You know, you see fine art.
Bronwyn Cosgrave hosts the fashion podcast, A Different Tweed. We met up in front of the store.
It's not just about shoes and handbags. You are conjuring a lifestyle.
She says flagship stores are an advertisement.
It's a big poster for your brand.
Maybe it says prestige. Or maybe it says fun, like the Lego flagship store, where there's a green dragon made of Legos coming out of the ceiling, and a sales associate named Max who walks over to us holding up a Lego in the shape of a T-bone steak.
Hello, it's nice to meet you. I just want to let you know, this here is a prime example of a rare piece.
And you have stand-up comedians operating as a sales team.
The thing is, operating a flagship store can be incredibly expensive. The average rent on Fifth Avenue is almost $3,000 per square foot. Add in the cost of designing and building the store, and you have to be really sure. Michael Londrigan at the Business and Fashion College LIM says once you do all that,
much more difficult than to rent or to sell or to move it to the next person, because they might come in and say, oh, geez, it's going to cost me that much more now to change it to my vision.
It sounds like Under Armour wasn't sure. It said today it's planning to focus on its smaller, more profitable locations. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You're on the wrong side of town. Now you gotta hurry up and make it to the other side in town. And it's a nightmare.
It's also an emergency. Rural first responders straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials barely budged today, down less than a point, closed at 29,276. NASDAQ up 10, about a tenth percent, 96.38. S&P 500 up 5, about a tenth percent there as well, 33.57. Under Armour, we talked about, shares sweated out 18.8% today. T-Mobile shares dialed up 11.7% after it got that merger go-ahead Molly and I were talking about. Sprint rang up more than 77% today. Sam Adams, brewer of the Boston Beer Company, is probably feeling a little bubbly after an analyst said the company could get a lot bigger. Boston Beer also makes Truly, one of those hard seltzers that for some reason are all the rage these days. Boston Beer, ticker symbol SAM, S-A-M, hopped up. Get it? Hopped up? Beer? Come on. Up 6.9%, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There are initial public offerings that go gangbusters that we all wish we'd had a slice of. Facebook, despite some early stumbles, is one of those. There are IPOs that don't go so well. Uber, anyone? And there are IPOs that never were. In that last category is a company called William Morris Endeavor, best known probably as a talent agency, but deep in the content business as well. But when it tried to go public last fall, Wall Street took a very public pass. Richard Rushfield wrote in Vanity Fair about WME's IPO and its main character, Ari Emanuel. Richard, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I think we probably ought to start with the dramatis personae of this whole thing and Ari Emanuel. Who is he and why is he?
Ari Emanuel is this character who from nothing built this kind of mega agency to be the first agency to challenge CAA. He has a brother who was the White House chief of staff at
another brother who's a doctor, right?
Another brother who led the reform of healthcare.
Yeah.
Under the Obama administration, and he was the subject of one of the more famous portrayals of Hollywood, played by Jeremy Piven on Entourage was based on him,
which was great. It was, and I think if you've seen that, you sort of it resonates with you. Okay, so he builds William Morris Endeavor, and to the point of this piece, tries to take it public. It fails spectacularly. Why? Because on the face of it, it's an interesting sort of promising business model.
The problem with taking an agency public is that what they say about agencies is you're in a business where your assets go home every night. It's your business based on relationships, and it's very hard to monetize and put a value on relationships. So what Ari did was he built this sort of conglomerate around those relationships. They went on this buying spree and they bought a rodeo. They bought a fashion agency. They bought they bought Ultimate Fighting. They bought all these other businesses.
Actual businesses as opposed to relational things, right?
Yes, real-life businesses that would create this sort of synergistic world with their clients. He calls it a 21st century media company.
Wall Street calls it, I don't think so, right? Because he lines up Goldman Sachs, tries to go public, and literally hours before, it evaporates.
Exactly. To the critics, people say, you can add on whatever you want. You're still an agency. Yeah. And also, you built up massive debt buying all these things. To them, they say they came in at possibly the worst time to be doing an IPO, just 2 weeks after the WeWork meltdown, days after Peloton. So they say when these things happen, the appetite on Wall Street for these sort of newfangled IPOs just evaporated.
And also, as you point out, Wall Street isn't and wasn't really sure what to make of this company.
At its core was an agency built on relationships with its client, but they had all these other arms to it that they had built on that they describe as a counterweight to the studios and the consolidation you've seen in the streaming wars, that they would become an alternate player that has, as I say, rodeos, has fashion, has all these other arms to it.
Two things on the way out. Number one, the schadenfreude in this town about Ari Emanuel maybe meeting his comeuppance?
Hollywood is a town that runs on gloating off other people's failures. And Ari has been such a high-flying, outspoken figure who's just done things so completely different from how everyone else has done them. There's no small amount of chuckling and glee about his comeuppance here.
Do you think then that this episode, taking the Ari Emanuel personality out of it, has this episode scared other companies like this, the CAAs, from perhaps trying to access the capital markets?
I think if Endeavor had been successful and launched their IPO, you would have seen CAA go that way. You would have seen other agencies try to go that way. Getting an IPO out of an agency was sort of the great last frontier that Ari hoped to achieve, and no one's gotten there yet as of now.
Richard Rushfield writing in Vanity Fair about Ari Emanuel, WME, and the great Hollywood IPO that wasn't. He is, in his day job, the editor-in-chief of The Ankler. That's a Hollywood newsletter. Richard, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
For a lot of people who live in a lot of the rural parts of this country, getting health care can be challenging at best. And the more rural you get, the more challenging it is. People out in far west Texas, which I learned today is the desert and mountains out almost to New Mexico, they describe their medical landscape as beyond rural, where a ride to the hospital in an ambulance, if there is an ambulance to be had, can take close to 3 hours. But there's something else standing between those far west Texans and emergency care, one they might not even think of until they need an ambulance to show up at their front door. Marfa Public Radio's Sally Beauvais takes it from there.
Eavesdrop on an emergency medical scanner in Presidio, Texas, and there may not be much to listen to. The population's just over 4,000. But when emergency calls do come in, the stakes can be unusually high. Local EMT Isidro Pondo remembers one such call.
It was a cardiac arrest, and they wouldn't answer the phone when we tried calling them. And what should have taken us 3 minutes took us about 15 minutes to get there. By then, it was too late.
What took so long? Trying to find the patient's house.
And it's frustrating and it's embarrassing when you go to the wrong address and you realize that you're on the wrong side of town. Now you gotta hurry up and make it to the other side in town. And it's a nightmare.
First responders here say it happens regularly. Dispatch relays an address, they rush to the scene, often using Google Maps, and find they're actually in the wrong place. Turns out this happens all over the country. Several years ago, the federal government ordered cell phone carriers to improve location technology for the benefit of people who call 911. But problems persist in rural America. A 2017 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found ambulance wait times in rural areas are about 15 minutes, almost double the national average. In Presidio, there are layers and layers of issues standing between ambulances and people's front doors. To demonstrate, EMS Director Melinda Richardson took me out for a drive in her Subaru.
Let's pretend that you have received a call to 411 Rosedale.
She emphasizes this is just a hypothetical example, but an especially good one. Within city limits, there's a Rosedale Avenue, a Rosedale Drive, and a Rosedale Street. Luckily, on this call, we know which one we're looking for.
411 Rosedale.
I enter the address into Google Maps, and we get going.
Turn right onto Bledsoe Boulevard.
So, is this Bledsoe?
No idea. No street signs.
No street signs. This is not Bledsoe.
She says spotty signage is just the beginning.
Head east on Commerce Street toward Harmon Avenue, then turn left onto Harmon Avenue.
Okay, this is another example. Harmon is the old street name. Ralph England is the new one, so Google Maps.
There are other discrepancies. Some houses have duplicate numbers. Some houses don't have numbers at all.
You've arrived.
Should this one be 411?
This one should be 411, but I don't see a house number on that particular house.
Here and in many other rural areas, street names and house numbers are a relatively new phenomenon. Many Presidio residents don't actually know what their official address is. They might have one assigned by the gas utility and another from the telephone company, and those might be different from what the city has. I went to talk to Alma Martin about this. She's chair of Presidio's Planning and Zoning Board.
Do you know where Alma Martin's house is?
Martin Street and her house are clearly marked, but I still got lost using Google Maps trying to find it.
I really, really want to get our 911 addresses in order.
Martin says before the times of smartphones and car GPS, physical addresses weren't really a part of life in Presidio. Residents relied on P.O. boxes for mail. The town was smaller and closer knit, and everyone knew where everyone else lived. But times have changed. The city recently secured $35,000 to get things in order. Martin's proposing a door-to-door address audit so they can finally ask people to
put their number on their front door for ambulance services, for fire departments, for law enforcement services, for the poor UPS guy, the FedEx guy.
She says once it's done, maybe the city can even contact Google.
You've arrived.
Lost in Presidio, I'm Sally Beauvais for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which A, makes me glad my kids are older, B, obliges one to ask how much money Disney wants anyway, and C, with which my friend and colleague Molly Wood will almost certainly disagree, It goes like this. It will now cost you, depending on the day you want to go, $209 a head to go to Disneyland and California Adventure. Yes, off-peak tickets are cheaper. And yes, there is the new Star Wars stuff. Molly's a big Star Wars geek. But still, $209. Parking, by the way, is staying a relative bargain. $25. All right, we got to go. Dow Jones Industrial Average literally flat today, down less than a point. The NASDAQ up 10 points, a 10%. The S&P 500 advanced 5 points. That is a 10% there as well. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.